Welcome to the Platform Journey from Tidemark, a growth equity firm purpose-built to help companies win and scale. I'm your host, Avanish Sahai. This series explores what it takes to build a successful software platform company and get the ecosystem flywheel going. We talk with seasoned innovators who have traveled this road before and can help navigate the way and share their lessons. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Platform Journey. Delighted to have another absolutely outstanding guest today, Andrew Casey, Chief Financial Officer of Amplitude, and similarly in other roles. Andrew, welcome to the Platform Journey.
Avanish, thank you very much for having me on. It's great.
We've known each other for a while, and you've been in some pretty amazing high-growth companies, but you're the ultimate business CFO. So talk a bit about your background, kind of your personal trajectory, and then we'll get into the meat of it.
That sounds good. So I would call myself an operational CFO. I didn't come up through investment banking or the traditional audit firm path, although I do have my accounting credential. I started my career really working in the business and learning the aspects of how a business works. And probably the foundations of that came through my Sun Microsystems days, where I started in manufacturing finance and understanding all the cost of goods, and then moved to an investor relations, and then did field finance, and then did corporate finance, and spent some time in our business units with marketing and with the development organization. So really learning the ins and outs of how Sun Microsystems worked. And I thought it was a great education. It gave you perspective about how the business worked. It built your business acumen. I learned how to influence and negotiate by going through those different areas. And it just made me a better business operator. And I've used that to this day as I've moved into the CFO role. And although I can do the accounting reporting and I get involved with all the technical things that you can imagine that a CFO does, I spent a lot of my time working with the business leaders, talking with customers, helping us to propel our strategic objectives. And I find that that's been the competitive advantage for me in the marketplace.
You're one of the best at that, Andrew. So I think it's a sign of someone who really understands all the different pieces, that it came up the hardware stack. And those of us in software often forget how hard that is and how critical that is, right? So thanks for sharing that. Now, you've been at some high growth companies like WalkMe and Amplitude. Talk a bit about who are they, what have they done, and how did you get into this? As you think about the business, how did you think about platforms and ecosystems, and why did that matter in those places?
Yeah, I would even go back a little further, Avanish, to the days you and I were working together at ServiceNow.
Yeah.
And would tell you that that probably was the foundations for me in building and scaling a business in a real way. Before that, I'd been at much larger companies like we talked about, Sun, Oracle, Symantec, HP. But when I moved into ServiceNow, it was the first time I'd gone to a company that had less than 2,000 employees. It was around $400 million in ARR at the time. But a lot of processes and systems were not well architected, and they certainly weren't enabled for scale. As we built the business at ServiceNow from that $400 million to well over $4.5 billion, there was a lot of things that we had to go build. And when Mike Scarpelli and Frank Slootman left and went and formed Snowflake, I had the opportunity to interview for the CFO job. And if I had been offered the job, I would have stayed for sure. But yep. Unfortunately, the board really wanted somebody who'd already been a CFO. So I competed heartily, because actually John Donahoe at the time actually asked me to participate and said, compete like hell, but this is your challenge. You know, the board wants somebody who's already been a CFO. And as we got through the process, certainly they selected Gina, and Gina's a great CFO. But the reason was because I hadn't been one. Now, John and Bill, who had been coming on at that time, asked me to stay around, because I knew the business really well, the board respected me. But the reality was the whole process convinced me I wanted to be a CFO. And so although they asked me to stick around, I told them I couldn't. And that's because that even if Gina decided at some point she wanted to retire, by their criteria, I still wouldn't be qualified. So I had to go leave and become a CFO. And it was quite serendipitous around that time, WalkMe was looking for a CFO to help them scale the business and go public. And I knew about WalkMe. We were a customer at ServiceNow. We had implemented a lot of business process automations through WalkMe. And for those people who don't know, it's It's really an in-application learning platform through which you can actually drive business process automations by understanding how people are interacting with those applications. This spoke volumes to me about how to drive and implement digital transformations at a time when most enterprises were thinking about how they automate more and more business practices through software. And so you saw this explosion of different software applications that were happening, especially as we moved into COVID. And the story was I joined WalkMe on March 2nd of 2020.
Ooh, I don't think I knew that.
A couple weeks later, we were obviously shutting down, trying to figure out how we'd run remotely. And we didn't even have a work from home policy. We had no real understanding of how we're going to operate remotely. And many of our customers had the same issues. But as we worked through the issues of working remotely for the first time, our business started to pick up in demand as most companies started to realize that this is a way to continue to drive interaction with their employees and get their business processes completed. So WalkMe was actually benefited by COVID. Throughout the summer, we had resurgence in enterprise business that was coming forward. I think we signed up close to 150 G2Ks over a six-month period. It was amazing.
Yeah.
By the end of that calendar year, the board was asking me to get WalkMe ready to go public, which I'd always wanted to do. It was something that, you know, every CFO aspires to take on a company and at some level take them public. I had the opportunity, but the board was a little bit misunderstanding of what was required. They asked me to do it and they said I had 2 months to do it. And I told them, that's just not going to work. we're not ready for that. And I told them, you know, the immaturity of the business was still one that we had to work on. Our processes weren't real hardened yet and didn't scale. But be that as it may, it was the right time to raise funds. And we went out in June of 2021. So that was about, you know, an 8 month period to get the company ready. Now, having said that, it was a great raise for WalkMe. They raised more cash than was necessary to reach our profitability goals, and it funded investment. And so it was a great time to raise. But the unfortunate thing, there was that immaturity issue on scaling and driving business processes wasn't there. And it really hurt when more macro issues started to creep up in late 21 and early 2022. Now, we were working through that, and ultimately it set up the company to operate at least a marginal level of growth. And as you probably know, the WalkMe was sold to SAP not too long ago. I had transitioned out of WalkMe around August of 2022. And the reason was because principals that I'd worked with before over at ServiceNow, Mike Scarpelli, David Schneider, Frank Slootman, they all asked me to go talk to Mike Spicer over at Sutter. Sutter was a big investor in Lacework, and they needed an operational CFO like me. Lacework had gone through a difficult time on hiring very rapidly, but then seeing the deceleration in the market and demand. And then their CFO had some issues personally, they needed to step away. So I came in and with Jay Parikh started to improve the business. We got it operationally sound and really focused on driving growth, and we were making great progress. Well, one of the things that happens in the Valley, when you make great progress, you start to draw the ire of big strategics who like what you're doing and would love to have those assets under their umbrella. And ultimately, that drove a process under which we sold Lacework to Fortinet. Now, the funny story I will tell you, and this is one that my wife often pokes me, given that she's the CFO as well, is that I signed the definitive agreement to sell Lacework to Fortinet on August 1st of 2024. And that was around noon. At 2 p.m., I became the CFO of Amplitude on August 1st. So I like to tell people, I had a two-hour break.
Two-hour break? Not even a weekend. That's awesome.
And the reason was Amplitude was, because Lacework's acquisition was fairly public knowledge that was going on, I had started interviewing different companies, and Amplitude did not have a CFO at the time, really wanted to before their next earnings, and their earnings was the following week. So I joined Amplitude so they could get the notice out that they'd hired a CFO.
Love it. So, Andrew, one of the things about you that, again, you said operational CFO, I call it a business CFO. I think we're saying very similar things.
Yes, they're very similar.
You got a very keen pulse on the business. And I think you think about scale. You think about scaling profitably and scaling in ways that are nonlinear and so on. And again, having worked closely with you at ServiceNow, it's going to see you in action. I think you brought that same mindset, for example, to WalkMe. You hired some of my old team there to help, or you connect some of my old team there to help with the same process. I think you're doing the same thing at Amplitude. What goes through your mind when you think about being both a C-level leader, but also a key advisor to the CEO and the board? How do you think about that, you know, that process of, hey, we need to think ecosystem, we need to think partnerships, we need to think things that may not have been part of our arsenal prior?
Yeah. There's two things come to mind. I have a phrase I tell my team and others that we have to play chess, not checkers. Mm-hmm. And when you think about when you play chess, you're thinking about several moves ahead. You're thinking about how you're going to move and how you're anticipating how your opponent's going to move and then how you will move from that. You're actually trying to think about the implications of decisions you're making in that game. And I think a lot that business decisions are that way too. You have to understand the implications of the decisions you make. And then what are you going to do when the invariable repercussions from those decisions come about? And it helps to clarify the right steps in strategy. Because I think the role of the CFO, especially for the companies that I've been in that are looking to build out a business and scale and drive tremendous growth, it's one in which you have to make investment pivots based upon the strategies and the steps that you're anticipating are going to occur over a period of time. And I can point out lots of different times, even, you know, at ServiceNow or WalkMe or Lacework or even now at Amplitude, when you're making adjustments in your strategy, that the CFO plays a really critical role in making sure that you're getting the right framework set up, that you're anticipating the right steps that need to happen in your systems, in your processes, in your reporting, how you're changing your comp design, how you're changing your territory design, your opportunity funnels, your partner ecosystem. You know, those things all are about the business, but the CFO has got to lean in and empower and align the organization around the achievement of those objectives.
Yeah. And I think if I could just add to that, if any one of those pillars doesn't fall into place, the broader goals are either much harder or maybe even impossible to achieve, right? They have to work in sync, right? And you talked about incentives and compensation. I mean, to me, that's been one of the biggest lessons I've learned in 15 years of doing this. If you don't get that right, you're not going to drive the right behavior.
You know, it's so funny you should mention that too. I had this discussion when I first arrived at Amplitude, that when I sat down with the CRO and the president, and I said, let's first talk about the strategic objectives we want to achieve, you know, over the next year and then the following 4 years. Like, what do we want to go do? What do you anticipate?
Yeah.
Because the way in which we'll design our comp plan will be one that incents the behaviors and actions for us to achieve those outcomes. And a lot of times what people do is they reverse that. They want to go start with the design rather than understanding what the design is going to lead to.
Yeah. At the end of the day, it's about people, right? And it's about people mm-hmm. and behavior.
Yeah.
So let's dive a bit into the ecosystem side. Again, you've been, I think, a strong proponent. You've been a huge supporter. What are the signals you look for to say, hey, this is the time? Yes, those are the strategic objectives of the company. These are the growth targets. This is how the street is perceiving us and so on. But what are the signals from maybe an internal readiness perspective? You say, you know, this is the right time and things are in place or not to take that step of action.
There's a number of things that come to mind, but maybe first I would go back even back to my Sundays. Bill Joy was somebody that I admired quite a bit. He's just brilliant. And one of the times I had him talk to investors, he was talking about how the world has a bevy of really, really intelligent people that can help you solve a problem, and because they take different perspectives on things. So you can never hope to hire all those brilliant people. You got to figure out how to tap into those capabilities to really take any idea you have and make it the best. That stuck with me for a long, long time. It still does, I should say. And it patterns which, you know, how you go about solving real problems that come up, whether those are problems of how you drive growth or whether those are problems that you have with design. And when it comes to partner ecosystems, the things that I would tell you is that the more that you can influence others that what you're developing is just a masterpiece in whatever you're doing, then the more you're going to get lift out of that. And that comes in the face, you know, for an enterprise software company, it comes with a product that adds really value to your clients and then extending the reach of your capabilities by having partners believe that and execute on that same objective. And I will tell you that there was a session you did with Kevin Haverty not too long ago. And I think that something he said was really very, very much the case with ServiceNow was, We had a product at that point in time that people loved, our customers loved, and they started doing something wonderful on it. They started building out their own workflows. They started building out their own use cases. And when that happened, it started to broaden out the number of people who could influence the future success of the products and the platform. And that came through partners as well. And so that's an early sign. Back to your question earlier, what's an early sign? Well, an early sign is, do you have a product that actually has those capabilities? Do you see the organic nature with which customers are using that product and they're creating new value propositions that maybe you didn't even conceive of?
That's right.
When you started. Right. And I would tell you, it's something I look for today when I was trying to figure out which company I want to go to post-Lacework. And Amplitude has that, because we're starting to see use cases with customers we never anticipate. You think Amplitude is an analytics platform, but people are using the analytics platform to go drive better marketing outcomes. They're doing loyalty programs. They're doing onboarding. They're doing, how do I better interface with my customers digitally in ways that we never even anticipated? And that creates this opportunity for then us to go showcase that to partners who can build those use cases at scale. So maybe we found a healthcare customer that's doing really great work with their own homegrown implementation of Amplitude for their emergency room engagement with clients. And they're delivering better emergency room services because they're analyzing the data and feedback that's going on there. Well, that's a great use case for a partner to go develop for every other hospital that's trying to achieve the very same outcome.
I just love that. I mean, here you're a CFO, but you're telling a story of an actual use case in a very specific industry that leverages your platform. I mean, that is exactly the beauty of it, right? Is finding those, sometimes diamonds in the rough, sometimes it's a pattern you see two or three times, and saying, look, this is an expertise that we probably don't have in-house. We may not need to have it in-house because the ecosystem can perhaps do it faster, do it better, do it at more scale, et cetera. Yeah.
And I think that it just more even at a less specific level, what we started to see in Amplitude was that new companies were actually sprouting up and building real revenue streams with applications that were surrounding the analytics platform, whether you think about it as a session replay or web experimentation or guides and surveys. You know, all these were applications that had built around a core analytics environment that Amplitude helped create. And it then provided a roadmap for us to start building out what we now consider our platform.
Yeah. So you talked about the product. I think one of the things you and I probably would agree on is also the team that is around, you know, you mentioned alignment earlier. Yeah. Talk a bit about, you know, what you'd look for in the team, right? Because it's a mindset. Not everybody has it or is born with it. So sometimes you have to find it. Sometimes you have to hire it. Sometimes you have to grow it. Talk a bit about the team and the team expectations broadly that he needs.
Yeah, so I would tell you, when I first was looking at different companies to join, team was a big, big part of it. I felt that at both Lacework and at WalkMe, there were gaps in that executive leadership team. And those gaps created, you know, an inability to actually achieve the overall objectives that the business had. And that's really hard to get the right team together, those components together that work really, really well together. At ServiceNow, we had Mike and we had Dave and we had Frank and we had a whole bunch of the executive team that just worked really, really well together, very well aligned. And so when I came to Amplitude, I assessed each one of the execs and how they were contributing, working together as a team. And it's one of the things that really attracted me to it. Thomas Hansen, who is our president and COO, was the one who recruited me into Amplitude and to go talk to Spencer, our CEO. And I was thinking at the time that, you know, the CFO-CEO relationship has to be really rock solid. I mean, you have to be on the same page. And you really can't have ambivalence in that relationship. And Spencer thought the same way. But having Thomas, the leader of the go-to-market team, recruit me in because he wanted a strategic partner in the office of the CFO was a big influencer as well. So you have to get that really strong dynamic, that cultural alignment. It's got to be there or a lot of things break down, as you mentioned. I think there's also a bit of that you have to influence the culture. I told the executive team when I first arrived here, you earn the culture we have. Hmm. And if we want a culture that's different, then we have to earn our way through it. And some of that means making changes to how we operate. Some of that means making changes to the people we have on the team. Yeah. Because sometimes people have great intentions and they may understand exactly what the problem is that that you want to go solve, but maybe they don't have the understanding of how to solve that problem.
They may have never done it before.
Yeah, and they may have never done it before.
Have not seen the movie before, right? Yeah.
I use a phrase that I told the board when I first started. You know, my team does a lot of admiring the problem as opposed to figuring out how
solving it. Yeah.
Solve the problem. And I think that comes with a little bit of inexperience. And we had a very inexperienced team when I first arrived. Now that's changed. That doesn't mean you have to have wholesale replacement of everybody within the organizations. But the more you can influence a good veteran group, you know, you bring in veterans, you know, with your rookies, you know, you get a better team dynamic. You know, you see this in professional sports all the time where you see the strong veteran, like with Curry, you've got a few others that have come on the Warriors team. They've got a good mix of veterans and rookies that really drive great team chemistry. Well, I think that's what we had to do as well. And, you know, as you do that effectively and you get everybody aligned on the things that are really important, you start to find that you get scale. You get a very focused organization that does better and better at the execution. Frank used to say, look, I don't want you to give me five things. I want you to give me one thing. What one thing are you going to do? And I'd say, you know, one of the things that CFO is very, very much it has to accomplish with a smaller company that's trying to grow is to drive alignment and focus around the investment areas that you're going to make. Yeah. Because you just don't have the resources to invest in everything and spread yourself very thin. You have to be focused and execute on the things that really matter.
Now, again, I think brilliant advice. Diving into the platform and ecosystem. I often, frankly, use those terms somewhat interchangeably, right? The platform is a technology side. The ecosystem, unless someone is extending, building, integrating, you don't really have a platform. I mean, you could have it for your own sake, but if no third party kind of validates that, how do you look at that? And how do you think about, again, to the point you just made about the investment strategy, right? One of the things we all often see, companies will put it on their website, hey, we're a platform for XYZ. Yeah. Then you look under the covers, it's not quite that. It's a fun thing to say, but how do you think about it? And how do you look to your peers in product and marketing and sales, et cetera, say, you know what, this is an investment that's worth making. And by the way, it's a long-term play. It's not something you do overnight. In order to do that, yes, I'm willing to work with you all to figure out the funding model, the resource model, the reallocation model, perhaps, to do that.
And I think you even have to overcome some misperceptions on what that journey really is, because what I've found in the three companies that I've been at that had at least endeavored to go create that journey to a platform, the reality is you often start from a single product and capability and you have a lot of resistance to moving away from what had worked and got into a certain level. So you have to almost break down some of those things in order to really take next steps forward. We talked a little bit about the product. The product's got to be something that engenders that ability to go create an ecosystem, something that other people are willing to invest in because they believe they can make money on it. And they can establish their own businesses. So that comes from a little bit of, hey, does the technology lend itself to it? I think that there's also this notion of you have to have strategies that attract the right technology partners, because in a complex enterprise ecosystem of technologies, there's no one tech platform that drives everything that Yep. a company uses to operate. And so whether you think of that in terms of customer service or some aspect of sales automation or marketing automation, there are vendors out there that you're going to want to partner with to really drive the right outcomes for the use cases that are important to your clients. And so for us, it's, you know, it's Braze and it's HubSpot and it's Klaviyo and others, because we're very much focused on how we drive the right solutions for people who are looking for marketing automation. And ServiceNow had its own, and WalkMe had its own, and Lacework had its own. So that's the first step. I think after that, then you start to work on how do you get the evangelical process started where people look at those capabilities and then they can start building their own solutions around it. And a lot of times what I've found is that smaller companies tend to give away the services that are associated with developing those capabilities under the auspices that they're trying to do and deliver a better customer experience.
Right.
And that may be the case. But the reality is that no partner, evaluator, reseller, or smaller, is going to invest in building their own practice, their own capabilities, if they think that there's, one, no business because you're giving it away for free. They don't want to compete with free. They want to understand that customers are valuing the solution that they're going to deliver, and they can charge a reasonable fee for it. So Very classically, when I first joined Amplitude, we were charging nothing for services. And now we're charging a rate, actually, which is much higher than what third parties would provide. And the reason is because I want to give an umbrella under which those partners can go develop a business that they can get a reasonable level of return. And suddenly that sets the dynamic with partners. Oh, wait a minute, are you saying that you're going to help me build a business around this? Well, yes, because we know and that we can't reach every customer. And we know that we can't be an expert in what every customer wants to do with our platform and how they want to use it to drive the right outcomes. But what we do know is that you can be on the front end of that, developing and leading areas where we had never even anticipated.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the next step. I equate it to when we were at ServiceNow and Evanish, when there were companies like Cloud Sherpas and Linium, you know, and nobody had ever heard of them. You know, there's smaller value-added resellers who built their business around driving service desk automation. And that led in then to a managed services business creation that, you know, was a whole new area of, you know, an evolution of the outsourcing business.
Didn't exist before.
Didn't exist. And then as those businesses got bigger and better, and you know, what you found was the global systems integrator started to say, hey, this is something we need to get involved in because we don't want to miss out on a major trend. And so many of those smaller companies got gobbled up by the global systems integrators because they wanted to have immediate capabilities brought into their organizations to go deliver this types of service. So for us at ServiceNow, that happened over like a four-year period. And I love to tell people that when we first joined, we had like 2% of our revenue coming from partner-sourced opportunities. But by the time I left, it was more like 45-50% of the
business. Even been higher, actually, I think. Yeah. No, it's, again, and one of the things, Andrew, that I always admired about you is in those conversations, right, when we would sit down and figure out, you know, deal structures and so on, exactly the point you just made, we were helping these folks build a business. Yeah. So you would ask questions, right, about, hey, what's the win-win? Right, if it's a win-lose, if we're keeping the margin more so than them and so on, that's not going to be a long-term business.
Believe it or not, I still use some of those principles, Avanish, today when I'm describing, you know, our pricing strategy or our negotiating strategy with our sales team. That like our number one principle is that we're trying to incent customer adoption of the platform because if they're using more of what we're doing, they're going to get value. The second is you were alluding to is that you want to have a fair exchange of value. You know, I've never had a customer tell me when I've had this discussion around our principles, how I approach the negotiation, tell me, Andrew, you know what? You're just not entitled to your fair exchange. You know, they're always a little taken aback and say, I like your thought process. Fair is good. And I will tell you that the other principles are around flexibility of usage and transparency, you know, and simplicity. Because enterprise customers, if you get too complex, they're not going to want to deploy your product and they're not going to want to do license administration for you. So they want to know that as they get greater value through use, you're not trying to excise tax them. You're trying to get to that exchange where the customer has the perception that they're getting value in advance
value.
Of what they're paying for.
Exactly. No. And again, I think that's one of the things that when I see things not working well, usually that is, you know, beyond the team and some of the other things we talked about. That is often one of the root causes, right? Is like you're just not, you know, putting, you know, the empathy piece, put yourself in the shoes of the partner and or the customer, usually both. If someone doesn't do that, then chances are you're not going to make it work. Let's switch a little bit of gears, but again, you started going down this path, but metrics. As a CFO, how do you know? What are the signs you look for? Is this working? Is this not working? Is this something I want to help scale? Is this like, whoa, you know, we're going down the wrong path? What do you look for?
So the first thing I usually do, and I had done this the last couple of times, so I will tell you, I'll talk to the FP&A leader that would be ostensibly working for me, and I ask him, how do you define accounts? How do you define ARR? How does that align to the comp plan structure and how is sales measured? And one of the things I found when I came to Amplitude was the more people I asked the different ways in which things were defined, and I immediately understood that there was some alignment that needed to happen.
Some dissonance.
on how we were reporting externally for how we were running internally. And then fortunately at Amplitude, when I joined, I had done my diligence on the accounting. There was nothing wrong with the accounting. The accounting was fine. Yep. But the interesting aspect was it was very similar to both Lacework and WalkMe before. It was built up during COVID. And so what you found was a lot of siloed operational structures and reporting. and people defining their own metrics and their own objectives for, you know, the planning period. And then, you know, that not well aligning to other business processes or, you know, the longer term strategic financials and strategic objectives we had. So when you have that difference in definition, the first thing that I do is start aligning and defining what exactly we're going to be doing from an external perspective. And for me in particular, I take a relatively conservative view on how we define our metrics. And it's because I want to be as transparent as I can to not just employees and our board and customers, but also with our shareholders.
Of course.
You know, in many cases, shareholders are investing in a SaaS, an enterprise SaaS application business like us. They want to understand that the annual recurring revenue that you're booking actually is going to be reflected in revenue in the 12 months that follows. You know, annual translates to 12 months later, I'm expecting this to. So there should be some very strict rules around what you define as revenue. And, you know, like we don't do things like if there's a monthly contract, you know, and there's no commitment, we're not going to annualize that.
Yeah.
And because the relative churn associated with those types of contracts is so high. And so if I was going to report, let's say a customer who came in at $10,000 per month is $120,000 of ARR, but they churn the next month, then I have churn of $120,000.
That's right.
And I really never realized the benefit of that contract. And so you redefine your metrics, you make sure that you're consistent with what investors expect and that you're reporting. That then translates into, you know, how you're going to drive behavioral focus from sales and what we're going to sell, how you're going to drive incentives around that, and certainly how you focus your customer segmentation and the areas you're investing to book those things. So metrics really, really matter. And I tend to define most of our internal metrics very much aligned with standards that are reported out, like the SaaS Metrics Board and others that have a consistent comparability. Because that's the other things investors want. They want to understand when you call net dollar retention, what does that really mean?
It's
comparable by definition. Yeah. And if you have gross retention, what does that really mean? Well, it's comparable. And so there are a number of different SaaS metrics that we've used and deployed and redefined in some cases to be very consistent with that comparability measure.
And so taking that to the partners, right? How do you bring that to the partner level as well? And what are the signals you're looking for? Hey, that the investment in the partner ecosystem is actually delivering that nonlinear growth or that kind of expansion of the TAM and so on.
So there's a couple of different areas. And partners come from both, you know, I'll call it delivery aspects for us because they'll do delivery. And then there is more of the sales and opportunity generation side.
Yeah.
So let me focus on the service delivery side. It's really around classic, what is your variable hours of service? We do time materials, we do completed contract type structures. And so those are very simple, but it gets back to, hey, we want to make sure we're talking apples to apples on rates so that we can best give you the incentive to invest and make sure that customers see you as an alternative to what Amplitude would have to do at a lower cost in our strategy. Now, on the sourcing side, it always comes back to, for me, having a registration process at scale and then the right incentive structures internally between your internal sales and external sales. Because invariably what happens when you have a direct sales force is you start opening up incentives for a partner structure. You have some conflict and you have to figure out how you navigate that. Now, if you have a very classic partner registration process like we do, what happens is a partner will come in through a portal, they'll register an opportunity, and then you've got to make sure that that opportunity compares to what your pipeline looks like. And if there's an existing opportunity out there, have a framework under which you determine whether you decline that or whether you accept it, and then a duration, you know, under which that opportunity is going to continue to be listed as a source from a partner. Now, we give incentives around that for the partner team. So they're incented to go bring forward opportunities that they believe they can close and win. And what I've had in my history, if you do this correctly, you actually get a much higher conversion rate associated with partner registration than you do with your own internal sales processes once they're registered. Because they typically, they don't want to go through a process of registration unless they've qualified themselves.
If they have high confidence.
And so if you do those things right, what happens is through your CRM system, if you do run your opportunity funnel right, your partner registration right, you get a bevy of partner-sourced revenue that's coming through, partner-sourced ARR, which ultimately turns into revenue. And that's a way to really look at how well the investments you're making in your partner investments, whether those are training or direct coverage on the partners themselves, the technical resources that are there to help the partners make sure they're delivering the right level of resources. If you get that partner source ARR and revenue coming through, then that's the easiest way to see you're getting a return on
investment. That it's working. Right. Yeah. Yep. Fair enough.
And then, as I mentioned, internally, you got to go address the conflict areas and make sure that the sales leadership understands the benefits associated with developing a partner ecosystem that is vibrant and that they're generating returns from their levels of investment. And to make sure that the incentives on the sales rep side are ones that I won't say completely ambivalent to the source, but one that they understand that it can accelerate their capability to attain.
Yeah, that's fair. Absolutely fair point. Anyway, as we wrap up, I know a lot of probably your fellow CFOs are in boardrooms and in C-suites having similar conversations, right? Which is, hey, are we a platform? Are we not a platform? How do we scale faster? One of the things I only half joke about is often it's the, you know, we brought someone in, we tried it for 6 months, it didn't work, so it doesn't work for us. What advice, what counsel do you give to someone like that? And how can they help their peer group or their colleagues think about this kind of in the very structured way that you just described?
Well, I will tell you, without sounding too supportive of you, I actually used the podcast that you did on defining the platform in this very conversation. And it's because it was so correct about how you think about the platform journey and what's really required. It's easy to say from a technology and a product perspective, yeah, we have a platform. We have multiple things that we can do. I'm like, well, that's not enough. It's really not sufficient. You may have aspirations to do that, but that's more of a multi-product strategy rather than a single product strategy. That's not a platform strategy. The other thing you have to understand is how customers are demanding your set of products. For Amplitude in particular, we had 3 or 4 products and we started thinking, hey, we might have a platform here. And the first thing I asked is, how many of those products get sold independently?
Yeah.
And the reality was, not many. That's why we started calling ourselves a platform, because we realized that, no, there is a definite customer journey associated with the adoption of Amplitude. People start with analytics 98% of the time.
Yeah.
And then they start adding these other capabilities and other personas, and they see multiplicative value across those personas. And then you can start saying, well, the product's actually set up to go drive a better customer experience the more you add. So it's a better together story. Remember that? Better
Love
together
it.
Story that you've got with the all your different products. So that's the first part. The other, as we talked about earlier, is the ability for customers to actually innovate on your platform and creating their own use cases and outcomes. In many cases, things that you didn't anticipate when you built the product and the corresponding other sets of product that works on your core. The analogy for me was at ServiceNow. We had ITSM, and then we built out different capabilities around the CMDB and the ITSM. Amplitude is the same way. It's just analytics is the core, and we built out these other products. But the customers using it and partners starting to pick that up and building their own solutions, that's another major step. Then I think it's how you are representing your platform to the market. I mean, and we're still going through this, to be frank, and that's how are you representing to clients the value proposition of adoption of your platform? And that comes through your pricing and packaging.
Pricing, packaging, positioning, right? Yeah.
Yeah. We had executive level conversations about this, the need if we wanted to be a platform company, and everything suggested from customer and partner feedback that we should, and that's the strategy we should execute. But we needed to have a pricing and packaging that amplified it. No pun intended.
Andrew, what a pleasure. And first of all, thank you for those very kind words. It means a lot. And you know, that is the objective of this series, really, is to bring those lessons all of us have learned along the way and say, hey, if you truly feel this is an objective, then here are some of the things you really have to think about to get it right.
Yeah.
Agreed. Thank you, Andrew Casey, CFO of Amplitude. Really delighted to have you on this leg of the platform journey.
It's a pleasure, Avanish. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us on this leg of the platform journey from Tidemark. For more insights, subscribe to this podcast and visit us at tidemarkcap.com.